Okay, so for any new faces, my name is Rob, and tonight I'll be discussing economics. The hope is that by the end of the evening, you should all, if you're new to physical economy, or LaRouche's form of economics, if you haven't investigated this before, you should have a decent basis to be able to understand the crisis that we're in and understand the solutions in a way that that you know, through any reading of the financial papers or the economics courses that are currently available cannot provide. Now, I don't profess to have mastered LaRouche's economics, but you know, I hope to share some insights from LaRouche and also from Henry C. Carey. And also, later on, we'll get into some questions of science and the nature of the universe, which we've been working on and hopefully should be somewhat provocative. Now, I started off, when we were deciding to do this cadre school, I'd recently acquired a three-volume set of by Henry C. Carey, who is one of the great American system economists of the 19th century. So I thought, well, okay, this would be a good opportunity to you know, read these works. They're beefy. I'm surprised I didn't get, go kind of half crazy reading this stuff all the time. But it was actually quite good. You gain a lot of, you know, he does a lot of work on history and other things. But as I was reading it, I realized that it would be unfair to simply treat Carey's work without addressing the advances that LaRouche has made in the science of physical economy, but also to bring added depth to LaRouche's own work, I also wanted to incorporate some of Carey's own developments and breakthroughs. So we're going to begin with some of Carey's material and go on and address LaRouche's economics afterwards, just to give you a general outline of the class. Now, the other title that I had for this was Why the Malthusians Are Idiots. And we're also going to determine that, you know, why the environmentalists are incompetent, and although they may be well-intentioned, but they don't really know what they're talking about. So, I guess one of the first questions that anybody who's going to study economy would ask is, why study economy? Well, what is economics? And what is the purpose of it? Well, Carey has some interesting thoughts on that. And hopefully by the end of the evening, I'll show you a picture of him later. But you'll also have a sense of the quality of the American patriot, you know, the true American patriot, contrasted to most of the garbage that we see today, or what's presented as American patriotism in the popular press, right, the kind of rah, rah, rah stuff. But now, he also, he opens the book by presenting some of the different opinions on what economy was at the time, and we'll actually get to a few of those in a moment. But this is what he says. We deem it the more to be regretted that such feelings should be excited, as they certainly have been, of these kind of dreary definitions and dreary opinions of the thing, because we know of no science, the study of which is calculated to excite stronger feelings of admiration. We know of none that displays more beautifully the perfect harmony of the laws of nature, or that is so little calculated to excite an unpleasant sensation. We believe that when properly expounded, those laws prove abundantly that, quote, God hath made man upright, end quote. While an examination into the various disturbing causes proves as fully that, quote, they have sought out many inventions, unquote. We think there is abundant evidence that the prosperity of nations and the happiness of individuals composing them are in the ratio to which the laws of nature have been allowed to govern their operations, and that the poverty, misery, and distress that exist are invariably to be traced to the interference of man with those laws, and that they exist in the ratio to that interference. If such could be shown to be the case, the laws of political economy might become the principle, perhaps the sole guide in the conduct of affairs. To prove this is the object we have in view. He goes on to point out that any laws which are going to be proven must be universally true. And this becomes important when he addresses the economics of Thomas Malthus and some of his contemporaries. Now, what is economics? Now, these are some definitions I collected. You know, I'm just going on the internet, check out Wikipedia, check out a few different sources and see what they're saying. Okay? So, the dismal science. That's one of the most famous ones.
What does that mean?
The dog wasn't so happy with that one. Well, dismal is like, you know, it's outside and you got these gray clouds hanging over the city and it's kind of dreary and raining. Yeah, puppy doesn't like that so much.
Is that what they mean by
dogma? Perhaps. Number two, economics is a science which studies human behavior as a relationship between ends and scarce means, which have alternative uses. Okay. Yeah, we'll maybe discuss these a little bit when we get when we're through them. Three, economics is the social science which examines how people choose to use limited or scarce resources in attempting to satisfy their unlimited wants. Okay. So two and three are somewhat the same.
Wait, hold on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a third you bring is they have unlimited wants.
It's weird. It's like the science which studies human beings.
Well, so fourth one I have here, the combined assumptions of maximizing behavior, market equilibrium, and stable preferences used relentlessly and unflinchingly form the heart of the economic approach. Seems a bit more professional, more academic. Yeah. Five. Economics explores and tests the implications of assuming that man is a rational maximizer of his ends in life, his satisfaction. What we shall call his self-interest. I know I was talking to a friend who studied economy in school, and I asked her what the role of the human being was in an economy. And she said, what do you mean, the rational actor? And I said, well, not really. But that's the interesting thing, is what you'll study is, as far as the human being is concerned, how do we make choices? That's really what they mean by rational maximizer. How do we make, what determines the way that we make choices? Do we want A or do we want B? How badly do we want it? That kind of thing. Now, six, and this one is, at least where I got it, said, well, you know, this is kind of a generic textbook definition that you would get in school. The study of how people use their limited resources in an attempt to satisfy unlimited wants is similar to the previous one that we had on that. Seven, economics is generally understood to concern behavior that, given the scarcity of means, arises to achieve certain ends. When scarcity ceases, conventional economic theory may no longer be applicable. Okay. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think of those definitions so far? Accurate? Inaccurate?
Certainly accurately.
Dismal?
Exactly how economics is
being pursued right now. Sounds pretty hands-off. Sounds like this is what you might study if you're trying to make money, become a businessman, or gamble in the stock market, but not if you wanted to be an economist, you wanted to actually improve the economy.
Any thoughts, Meredith? So, if these seem to be missing something or not correct, then what is a proper definition for economics or mission statement for the study of economy? Well, I was thinking about that a little bit, and I thought that at least as a beginning, at least to get us on the right path, that the purpose of economics may be to explain the causes of this. It might be a bit harder at the back to see what's going on here. But is that kind of clear what, you know, we're looking at this population increase? I think the class that Val gave earlier on the Renaissance and things like that. Well, and the outcome of that is going to be important in studying this. We're going to come back to this chart a couple of times. But the obvious question is, why do you get this explosion of population density, and life expectancy when you do? And why not some other time? That's the proper question to ask. Why does the explosion of population, the increase of population density, and life expectancy happen when it does, and not at some other time? Why didn't it happen under the Roman Empire? Or under the control of the Venetian banking system? Okay. What do you guys think? You have to use your bel canto voice.
Maybe I'm wrong, I don't know. But what I'm saying is, it's included in the population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously something has to be changing in the economy. And that's what we want to figure out. Yeah. And this is really the question that Carey takes up in these books. Now...
Can I ask?
Mm-hmm? Yeah. Yeah, sure.
If you look at the chart, how it works,
mm-hmm.
It's not simply obvious, not just natural. So whatever might have caused this revolution has to jump to the eye of any of the
mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's so very complicated to understand. It might cover a whole ton of people's ideas.
Yeah, maybe what happened is we discovered all this area, so that then allowed us to, you know, because we had a fixed amount of area, and so that means we could only grow a certain amount of food in Europe. So we expanded into the New World, and we were able to loot the resources from that area, but now it's all coming to an end. That might explain it. True. Yeah, that's the, it's not, things couldn't have just continued as they were before. You're not going to last too long here, dog. Okay, so, this is the question of the American system economists who take up this question of what is actually, building civilization. Now, something interesting about Carey is that he didn't kind of just wake up one day and decide to be an economist. He's like, well, I'd like to be an economist today, and you know, he sat down and wrote this volume. That's not how it happens. Because, and you can get a sense of that simply by looking at the chapters in here. Because about half of the book is actually a prolonged refutation of the entire British school of economy.
Wow.
He refutes Malthus, Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, Jean-Baptiste Say, Colonel Thorne, blah, 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 a bunch of other fellows that are not so well known now. But pretty much the whole school. Now, one thing that I found that was interesting, that he doesn't go after Adam Smith. He almost never mentions Smith.
Huh.
And also reading the books, I have a suspicion now that he started this in 37 and he finished the third volume in 1840. I don't think he really understood the British Empire yet. In the way that he understood it in, say, 1850, the early 1850s, or even maybe later in the 1840s, because in free trade in the United States really comes in 1846. The British go into an accelerated drive for that, and of course then you have the drive into the Civil War and everything, and I think it becomes a lot more explicit that the British are the enemy. Because the way he's treating England in here is not really as a hostile foe, or anything like that. He's also not promoting protectionism. That's curious. He's actually promoting more a form of free trade. He's advocating the lowering of the tariffs that the United States has at the time. So, again, as always, when you start to investigate these historical characters, they're not some fixed thing. You know, Carey wasn't born this patriotic warrior, you know, for protectionism in the American system. But that came over time. But what is an invariant throughout his life is what he's dedicated to, as I read there, the harmony of interest. Right, that there's no difference between the interests of the capitalist and the interests of the laborer or the merchant. The question is how you carry that out under the circumstances that you're given. Right? If all the nations on the earth are honestly attempting to develop themselves and cooperate, then protectionism is not necessarily required. But if you have this empire that's out to destroy you through economic subversion and so forth, then it might be a different situation. So that was something interesting that I found. So this is the rogues gallery. These are the three main guys. Now, it's important to note that the fellow up in the corner there, it looks like he's mad, you know, a bit insane. He actually did go insane. That's John Stuart Mill. And he was the protege of Jeremy Bentham and his father, James Mill. So he was one of the big guys within the British East India Company during the 19th century. The guy in the middle here, this is Thomas Malthus. And he's kind of the godfather of the whole environmentalist movement. He was also the head of the Haileybury School of Economy, which was the training ground for the British East India Company. And this guy up here is David Ricardo. So these were the really, the giants in political economy in the early 19th century.
So you said these are the guys that actually he goes after in this book?
Yeah.
With the French?
The French, yeah. But it's mostly, it's all British. I mean, there's you know, one Frenchman. There's a couple Frenchmen that are writing on economics, but it's totally dominated by the British. And you can imagine, at this time, I mean, they were sending these works around the world. And he had this funny thing at the beginning, and Carey's not the only guy to mention this, because Friedrich List, who is a contemporary, does the same thing. He writes in the preface, in the first paragraph, and he's talking about himself in the third person. He is fully aware that by a large portion of those who think upon political economy, a doubt of the truth of those doctrines, that is of Malthus, Ricardo, and so forth, a doubt of the truth of those doctrines is considered as evidence that they are not even comprehended, and that therefore his book is likely to be thrown aside as unworthy of the time required for its perusal. Right, so if you contradict the policies of these British economists, you must just be incompetent. You obviously didn't get it. It's like the guys today who are, you know, promoting free trade. If you're not free for free trade, then you obviously don't get free trade. It's kind of a similar thing. You never know what conditions you have to give classes under, huh? Got to be ready for everything. Right, dog? All right. So how does Carey define economics? Here's a picture of him, by the way. Now, contrast this to what we saw earlier. Right? Political economy is the science which traces the laws of those phenomena of society which arise out of the desire of mankind to maintain and improve their conditions. And that's quite different. Because, you know, something about all of these other definitions, remember them, they kind of, at least it's implied anyway, that you're dealing with some sort of fixed system. You're making choices in it, but things are pretty much fixed. They're not really changing at all, right? You know, limited resources, scarce means, that kind of thing. How are you going to maximize your self-interest? Whereas there is a certain element to this definition of transformation. And he describes in the beginning of the book, well, how he comes to that definition. And what he's looking for is something that encapsulates all of the various activities of that would take place in an economy. Yeah, but which also does not leave out moral questions, political questions, and so forth. Now, one thing, let's open this up. What I decided to do, instead of try to summarize the work itself and what Carey does, is to actually take the summaries of volumes 1 and 3, which are the more relevant, and we can read through them. And in this way, we can also discuss what he's talking about, and we should have a good basis by the end, you know, in general questions of economy and development and things like that, to then look at LaRouche and have a grounding to help us understand what LaRouche is saying about economics and how nations develop and so forth. So, okay. All right. Now, is this, is that, I'll make that larger. That's better? That might be a bit easier.
No.
Okay. All right. And I think do this in a better way. No, that's nice. Like a reader? Yeah. Like that? Is that big enough now, or is that? You might, I mean, there's a few seats up here for people if they want to move up a bit. Okay, so, you know, so what he's got here, he has these at the end of his books. These are the propositions. Like, he's gone through this, you know, all of this, and he reduces it to a set of propositions, which are, you know, they develop in the way that he develops his ideas, so it should be straightforward to go through them. And whenever there are questions, and comments, you know, we can have discussion around this. So, does somebody want to read the first one?
Sure. Principles of Political Economy, 1837, Volume 1. We now submit to the reader the following proposition, embracing the result at which we have arrived. One, that man desires to maintain and improve his condition. Two, that he endeavors to accomplish this, object by applying himself to the production of such things as are either useful or agreeable to him. Three, that as he cannot increase or decrease the quantity of matter of which the world is composed, he has it only in his power to alter in its form or in its place the matter already existing. Production, therefore, consists in the appropriation, alteration, or transportation of the gifts of nature. before, that the articles so produced have value in his estimation because of the labor that has been given in exchange for them. Five, that the values thus produced constitute his revenue. Six, that a proposition of his portion of his revenue is applied to the satisfaction of present wants, and the remainder is laid by for future enjoyment, or to aid him in future production.
That clear so far?
Yeah.
And one thing in terms of value, because this is a big one right now, you know, when he talks about value, he doesn't talk in terms of money. He talks in terms of what is required to produce an item, like how many hours. He begins off and he develops this little society of a couple guys living close by who are gathering food or producing potatoes or corn, things like that. You know, and if they're going to exchange goods with each other, what would be the basis for that exchange? How would they measure the value of their goods relative to the goods of another? And he says, well, they would measure it in terms of the labor required to produce that amount of goods. And they certainly wouldn't trade, say, you know, they want to trade one guy wants to trade a bushel of corn for a bushel of potatoes. You know, if it took him twice as long to produce that bushel of corn as to produce a bushel of potatoes, would he trade that for one bushel of potatoes, or, you know, that kind of thing, or would he, or would the other guy, you know, wait, I messed that up a little bit. Yeah, would he trade twice of his labor for, you know, I'm confusing myself. Yeah. Is the guy who worked twice as long going to trade it for, say, half the labor value? Right? It's like, if I have a dollar, am I going to trade with somebody else for 50 cents? Yeah. It has twice the value. So he's thinking in terms of labor and how, as a measure of value as opposed to money, which is interesting. You want to keep going, Beth?
Oh, yes. Seven. That the portion thus laid by constitutes his capital, under which head is embraced all articles possessing exchangeable value, whether in the form of land, houses, ships, provisions, diamonds, or commodities of any other description. Eight, that capital aids labor and increases the power of production. That it also facilitates the division of employment and combination of labor. Nine, that labor thus aided is improved in its quality. Ten, that every improvement in the quality of labor tends to diminish the quantity required for the production of any commodity and to facilitate its acquisition. 11. That the value of all commodities at the time of production is estimated by the quantity and quality of labor required to produce them. 12. That as every improvement in the quality of labor tends to diminish with the quantity of labor required for the production of any commodity, it follows that it also diminishes the quantity that can be obtained in exchange for commodities of a similar description already given. Can I read that?
Yeah.
That as every improvement in the quality of labor tends to diminish the quantity of labor required to the production of any commodity, it follows that it also diminishes the quantity that can be obtained in exchange for commodities of similar description already accumulated.
Yeah, take an example of, well, he uses, okay, say you've got a guy who wants to build a house, and he's got a crude axe and crude implement with which to build it, and say it takes him 6 months to build his house, okay? Now, say a few years go past, and, if he was to say sell that house, he would sell it for something that would be the equivalent of 6 months of labor. Maybe it's food or other commodities, things like that. But now, what if a little while later he gets a superior axe, which allows him, and superior tools, which allow him to construct a house in 3 months' time? Right. So, what's the value of this older house? You know, if both houses were to be offered for sale at the same time, one's offered, the labor value is 3 months, the other 6 months. You know, if the two owners are trying to sell it, which one is going to be sold? Yeah. So it's like, take any technology, whether it's iPods or DVD players or computers, over time how the price, not just of new computers, but of all computers, tends to diminish. You know, just because a DVD player was built last year, at a higher cost of production, it's not going to be sold at that higher price.
It's an extra,
currently, right?
It's an extra incentive to invest in new technology if that's what makes you competitive or increases your value.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody will, they won't want to keep the money because it's old, shoddy.
Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of a paradox, in a way, because every technological advancement diminishes the value of your capital.
Right.
So, what the hell? Adam Smith would be freaking out. You know, these guys, because they're thinking, that's my money. So, if you're a dumb oligarch, I mean, doesn't seem to be in your interest. Any questions about anything else that he's saying there so far? You're going to have to use Bel Canto. You're a long ways away. It's true that it diminishes the value of your capital, but is that a threat? I don't know. It's making you more efficient. But it's a paradox. Because at first assumption it would seem like a bad thing that the value of your machinery or your other goods are decreasing. You want to keep reading? Okay, so we're at 13.
13. But there is, therefore, as labor improves in quality, a constant tendency to diminution in the quantities thereof that can be obtained in exchange for existing capital. The value of the latter is limited by the cost of reproduction.
As we were discussing.
Which he retains is termed wages, and that which is received by the owner of capital is termed profit. 16. That wages are the reward of human labor, of the exertion of skill or talent. 17. That profits are the compensation paid for the aid of things having exchangeable value. 18. That the profits of trade are a combination of profit of capital and wage of labor, or superintendence. 19. That when labor is of inferior quality, production is small, capital is accumulated with difficulty, and the owner thereof claims a large portion of the product in return for granting its aid. 20. That at the time, the quantity of commodities to be divided is small. That at the time, the quantity of commodities to be divided is small. The laborer's proportion thereof is small, and he obtains with difficulty necessaries of life. The proportion of the capitalist is large, but the quantity of the commodities is small, and thus he obtains but a small amount of the conveniences and necessaries of life in return for the use of capital produced at great cost of labor.
Okay. Let's pause there for a minute. What do you guys think of that? The questions are.
I find it interesting the development of the difference between wages and profits.
Mm-hmm.
When the labor is of inferior quality, the labor is paid little, and the capitalist also gains relatively little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you can imagine, Carey in his book, he compares four nations in particular. The United States, England, France, and India. And he's comparing how the economies there are functioning. And he he finds something quite interesting, that in a nation, the United States, which had at the time about 15 million citizens, compared to India, which had about 200 million citizens at the time. Well, they weren't really citizens, but people. That the and the British East India Company was running India. Now, they were taking anywhere from 50 to 70% of the production of the Indian population in taxes. And yet, the total amount of taxes that they were able to collect was very, very small. It was actually lower than the other three countries. Each of the other three countries. Now, that's curious because here's the state or the capital. It was really the same thing. The landowner took a big chunk, and then the British East India Company took a big chunk from the landowner. And then there's all kinds of other taxes. So you've got the poor Indian farmer with like a twig trying to scratch the ground and grow some food, and he barely survived. And often, you know, then if a drought happened, you get a wipe out of a huge part of the population. You know, so the company is taking the majority of the produce, and yet there's still very, very little to be taken. So, and he finds that is the case wherever production is low. Because you can imagine if the amount of labor that would be involved to produce, you know, instruments or implements for farming and things like that would be very expensive. If you have almost a labor force with almost no skills. So it's going to be expensive to loan it out or to borrow it. You know, like a hoe or to borrow something like oxen or something like that. But you hardly produce anything, so you don't have that much to pay the capitalist anyway. We can continue.
21. If the quantity of commodities to be exchanged is small, and if both laborer and capitalist are obliged to allow to the dealer a large proportion to be retained by his profit from trade, thus diminishing greatly their power of obtaining the necessaries for convenience of life. 22.
Wait. The quantity of commodities to exchange is small?
If the, because the quality of the labor is poor. So you need the services of the dealer to take more and more portion of it.
Like, say, a merchant. Like, you can imagine, you've got some guy who's in a town, some wholesaler, right? So he's going to take in all of the produce of the local farmers, and then he's going to ship that off somewhere else. Now, if the amount of production is really low, well, the merchant has to stay alive. So he's got to have enough income to feed himself and everything else. So if the production is low, he's going to need a large portion of that production. Right? But if there's a huge amount of production, so he only needs a small proportion, a couple percent. Like today, you take a grocer, for example, right? I mean, a grocer maybe has a 2%, 3% profit margin for the goods that he's selling, but the amount of food is so large that he can still make a reasonable profit off it. But that's maybe for a city. So if it's a little town of just a few people, and you've got to, you know, goods are going to be much more expensive because he's not selling as much. You can see how that can work.
The hand labor is purchased in quality. It becomes more productive. Capital is accumulated at less cost than the labor, and its owner can demand a smaller proportion of the product in return for gifts granted in need. Three. That with every improvement in the quality of labor, the quantity of commodities to be divided is increased. This increased production is dependent by the power on the part of the laborer to retain a constantly increasing proportion of the commodities he produces. He is, therefore, constantly improving his condition. 24. That although the proportion of the capitalist is constantly diminishing with the increased production of the laborer, this diminished share gives him a constantly increasing quality of commodity, a quantity of commodity, enabling him to increase his consumption while he rapidly increases his capital. Thus, while the facility of accumulation is constantly increasing, there is a steady diminishing
recap?
Yeah. Or maybe we should go back.
Yeah, I can go back. Right. Yeah, well, you can imagine.
Yeah, it's still getting more.
Yeah. If you've got, you know, you've got some farmer, whatever it is, hat or whatever.
Wait. What's that hat? Yeah, that's a farmer.
There. Okay, so he's got his pitchfork there. say, you know, if he produces, say, a thousand, or let's say 100 bushels of wheat, okay, and you've got the capitalist over here, who's got, you know, he's got the money. He's holding the bag of money. Now, say he's loaning him money to buy fertilizer, buy other things, but, you know, since the production's very low, for what he's doing, the charge might be 50 bushels of wheat, right? For example, say this guy is loaning him also oxen or other implements, right? So he requires 50 for his job. So that leaves the farmer with only half of his produce. But say with this, you know, over time, the farmer clears some more land. Right, or he saves up some of his own money to buy his own animals or whatever, maybe he's able to double his production. Right, so now he can produce 200 bushels of wheat, but he needs to borrow the same amount from this guy, fertilizer and so on, but maybe he needs to borrow more of some things and less of others. So he still borrows 50. Well, now the proportion kept by the farmer is 150, right? Or alternatively, if he says, well, I want 50% of your product, you know, because it's small, well, to get his 50, you know, when it's 100, he needs 50%. But when what he really needs each year is 50 bushels of wheat. That's what he needs. Well, if this guy is then able to produce 200, what percentage does he need to get his 50 bushels of wheat? He only needs 25. Right. So this is the kind of thing that you're looking at. But you want to think in terms of a nation also where people are accumulating money. You've got more physical wealth going around. So, over time, the guys with the money that want to loan it out are having to compete more and more with each other. But that's what he's getting at. And this is, you know, he says at the end, this is actually what we've seen. You know, he's stating this right here, but this is what he goes through the book proving.
Interesting.
You wouldn't hear Marxists saying that.
our captain.
Mm-hmm. The captain is playing the pitchfork to the guy. She gives it to that pitcher. So later on, the captain then lends a tractor.
Yeah.
Which he needs actually 200.
Mm-hmm.
But for the tractor, the farmer is actually able to produce 1,000 instead of 100.
Yeah.
So now the farmer is left with 800. The captain gets 200. But instead of that being 50% of the profit, or of the now only 20%.
Yeah.
You
could think today, like with Africa, for example. And Lynn, I think it's in Operation Juarez. Not this relates to Africa, but said, you know, it would really be in the best. This is during the debt crisis in the early 1980s, and he was writing about the potential for development in Ibero-America. Says, look, you know, any sane banker in the United States or Europe would jump at the opportunity to restructure this whole third world debt and create the conditions for increased lending to these countries for the development of agriculture and infrastructure and other things, they would actually massively increase the amount that they could lend by helping these nations to develop. Like you're saying, you know, if they have to be buying more tractors and more fertilizer and all these things, they're expanding production, they need the funds in order to do that, to make that expansion happen. So, you know, there is no contradiction between what he's saying here, the interest of the capitalists, the interest of really everybody in the society. That's a really key point. You know, that these social funds, too, they just don't get it. Or even the union guys, you know, they think it's the capitalists, they're the problem. Well, who's employing you, buddy?
Also, man, there's a distinction between the capitalist and the trader.
Yeah.
And the capitalist actually has some sort of physical capital it seems that's involved in producing something as opposed to just the, you know, the
moving
little,
things
little
around.
Man. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and I think just that South American model is that in the scenario that you described, you'd have an actual increasing productive capacity of that area.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to what Val described earlier. The imposition of certain rules on lending, which is forcing them to engage activity, which has the effect of decreasing production.
Yeah.
So you have this effective engagement in that type of activity, which is decreasing production.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the dollar in the world market is constantly increasing in value.
Yeah.
So you have a situation where no chance of
escape. Yeah, there's no escape from that. Mm-hmm.
27, we have that the world at large is governed by the same laws which govern the individual laborers and capitalists, or any number of them constituting a community or nation. Does anyone else like this?
Yeah. 28, that the interests of all nations are therefore in harmony with each other. As every measure that tends to lessen production in one nation tends to lessen the reward of both laborer and capitalist in every other nation, and every measure that tends to increase it tends to increase the reward of the laborer and capitalist in every other nation. 29. That it is therefore the interest of all that universal peace should prevail, whereby the waste of population and of capital should be arrested, and that the only strife among nations should be to determine which should make the most rapid advances in those peaceful arts which tend to increase the comforts and enjoyments of all the portions of the human race. 30, that the desire of improving his condition impels man to desire the aid and cooperation of his fellow men. 31, that in the infancy of society, the want of capital compels him to depend for a supply of the necessities of life upon the appropriation of those articles produced by nature without his aid, and he is compelled to roam over extensive tracts of land to obtain sufficient to support existence. He relies exclusively exclusively upon the superior soils. 32. That he is therefore compelled to live apart from his fellow men, or to associate with them in very small communities. Population is, consequently, thinly scattered over the land. Fertile land is abundant, but he has not the means of rendering it productive. 33. That is successful in his search after food, he does not possess the means of transporting or of preserving that which he does not require for immediate consumption. His life is therefore a constant alternation of waste and starvation. He is poor and miserable. 34. That with the first accumulation of capital, he acquires the power of resorting to an inferior soil for subsistence. He finds that a more limited space will supply his wants, and he is enabled to draw nearer to his fellow men, to unite with them in division of employments, and thus to obtain their cooperation, by which the labor of all is rendered more productive. 35. That his implements are, however, still rude, and he is obliged to scratch over the surface of a large quantity of land to obtain what is necessary for his support. The surplus above what is necessary for his own consumption is small, and the exertions of nearly the whole of the community are required to secure a supply of food, leaving few for the preparation of clothing, the building of houses, or the production of any other of the comforts of life. His condition is improved, but he is still poor and miserable. 36. That with the further accumulation of capital, he brings into action soils still more inferior, and with every such change finds increased facility in obtaining the necessaries of life from a diminished surface. He is, therefore, enabled to draw daily nearer his fellow men, and daily more and more to cooperate with them, by which cooperation his labor is rendered daily more productive. This increased facility of obtaining the means of subsistence causes a constant diminution in the proportion of the population required for the production of food, and enables a constantly increasing proportion to apply themselves to the production of clothing, shelter, and the other comforts of life.
Good so far?
That thus, as capital increases, population becomes more dense, and the inferior soils are brought into action with a constantly increasing return to labor. Men are enabled to benefit by the cooperation of their neighbors, and the habits of kindness and good feeling take the place of the savage and predatory habits of the early periods. Poverty and misery gradually disappear and are replaced by ease and comfort. Labor becomes gradually less severe, and the quantity required to secure the means of subsistence is diminished, by which he is enabled to devote more time to the cultivation of his mind. His moral improvement keeps pace with that which takes place in his physical condition, and thus the virtues of civilization replace the vices of savage life.
Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah.
Now,
1837.
Yeah. I mean, now, okay, we're going to get into this later, but for those of you who have looked at, know a bit about LaRouche's economics, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
I think he would be bringing all of this to bear. With what he paints here, though, obviously he's talking more about the process of physical production. But if you note here, he's referring as agriculture becomes more productive, as labor becomes more productive, fewer people have to devote themselves to growing food. Just like, if you even look at the development of Canada or the United States, or really any nation, in the beginning of the development of a country, most of the people, like maybe 80% of the population, will be growing food, because you barely grow enough to keep yourself alive. So if you can only do that, it's obviously you can't support other people as well. Maybe it's just your family. So everybody's got to be doing that. But if what happens if, you know, you double the production of food for your farmers? Well, then now maybe only 40% of the population needs to farm. Now you've got 40% of the population that's freed up to do other things, like build machinery for the farmers to further increase their production. So that's, you know, but of course also included in this education, science, and things like that. But obviously that's all part of labor. Mm-hmm.
Higher level of
mental activity. Yeah. Now, I was just going to say, for those of you who are a bit familiar with some of the concepts that LaRouche talks about, one we'll get to later, potential relative population density, Carey's already thinking about that. Do you see that?
Yeah, yeah.
1837, and the guy's already got that concept, that this is what's driving, this is really at the heart of progress, the increase of the potential, the capability to support more people on less land. I mean, that just, you know, that blows my mind. Sometimes it's even more explicit. This is, you know, I just couldn't find it. It's in the second volume somewhere, but he's got this one paragraph for it.
You can write on the notes.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to go back to one thing. You notice he talks a lot about how we move to the inferior soils. We start to cultivate more and more inferior land, mm-hmm. and make it productive. Well, there's a reason he stresses that a lot. Because if you go back to the, well, I'm not going to go to it now, but to the Rogues Gallery, mm-hmm. These guys here, they had these theories on land that they were talking about. Like, what is it that determines rent? Things like this. And also, this is intimately related to Malthus and his work on population, which we'll get to a little bit later, which is very important today. Today, it's got a different variation. They say limited resource and so forth. But at that time, the main argument was that the amount of population increases geometrically, and the food supply increases arithmetically. Now, why do they say arithmetically? Okay, population. Carey actually goes through at the beginning of volume 3, and he shows, like, okay, if you set up a certain thing, you can show how a population does grow geometrically. Yeah.
I think they say arithmetically because they're assuming no attack.
Right.
They're assuming they're constantly the same mode of
production, mm-hmm.
including the concept of increasing. Hell, that won't even increase at all after a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's just it, you know. So, in a sense, the earth is some. Things are fixed. The earth is fixed. You know, the application of labor to the land cannot improve the quality of the land. That's totally absent. So you can imagine, you know, they say, okay, well, obviously then people are going to settle on the best lands first, you know, by the rivers and things like that, the open plains. And then when that land's all filled up, mm-hmm. population's going to increase, right? Because, you know, people can't control themselves. And that's going to put pressure on the food supply. So maybe you're going to get some guy who's going to go and clear some land, but it's rocky land or something. So he's not able to produce enough. And that's going to cause, that's going to bring about the so-called remedies that Malthus refers to. So there's going to be a reduction in the population and things like that. But that there's a limit, because what are you going to do when that land's taken up? What's the next option? A swamp? What are you going to do then? So that was their basic conception. They were writing books on this to try to justify why the rents, in my sense anyway, why the rents were 70% approximately in India, or why the people in Ireland, like these landlord systems, you get these oligarchs who would go and own thousands of acres and have these poor serfs working them, like barely staying alive. Why is it that, this is happening? It must be because there's some natural value in the land, which is owned by the landowner, and, there must be too many people. That's why there's not enough food, why they're all starving. It's like them. People just don't think about it. They don't think through the argument. They just see something and they say, well, there's poverty there, so there must be too many people for the amount of food available.
Or, intrinsically, it means to focus on the poor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So it's kind of, this is the kind of thing that's going on. But Carey has a funny way of addressing this. It's tongue-in-cheek, that's for sure. Because he does a review of the population theories of all these people. Malthus, Ricardo, and Mill, and so forth. And he he says, the discovery of Malthus was that however rapid might be the improvement of cultivation, there was a constantly existing tendency in population to outstrip production. And that therefore, were the earth ultimately capable of affording support to 1,000 millions of times its present population, every stage of its increase must be attended with a pressure of population against subsistence, producing a copious harvest of vice and misery. Right. And then he says, how far this actually is truthful, we'll find out. He then goes on to say, this is the summary also of Malthus. It is assumed that moral restraint, inducing abstinence from marriage and so forth, will work. Otherwise, if that's not taken up, leading to vice, wars, pestilences, and famines, causing misery and starvation, that these are the remedies provided by nature for counteracting the tendency to overpopulation. The superiority of the people of England and France over those of some other countries, such as India and Ireland, is then attributed to the fact that the population has accommodated itself to more nearly to the average produce of each country than many other states. By the operation of the preventive check, wars, the silent, though certain, destruction of life in large towns and manufactories, and the close habitations and insufficient food of the poor, these are all quotes, which, quote, prevent population from outrunning the means of subsistence, and which, quote, supersede the necessity of great and ravaging epidemics to destroy what is redundant. So the nations apparently that move forward and progress are the ones that learn how to keep their numbers under check by means of, having cramped quarters and things like that. But, he says something funny. If the checks referred to were really remedies, an examination of Mr. Malthus's work should satisfy us that where they had been applied most frequently and copiously, the supply of food bore the highest ratio to production, or to population, right, would make sense. And that where they did not exist, the population tended most to exceed the supply of food. Clear? If Malthus was right, where his so-called remedies, right, starvation, famine, what else did he say? Famine, war, pestilence, vice, misery, this kind of thing. Wherever that was present, you should find the most prosperous people. That's essentially what Malthus is saying. Right? Well, that because Because that's reducing population, so therefore producing more wealth.
Wherever you find poor?
Yeah, he says, if Mr. Malthus is correct, we should be able to investigate various nations and determine that where Malthus's remedies, or that is also population reduction, where these have been applied most frequently and copiously, the supply of food should bear the highest ratio to the population. Right? So those should be the places that have the most food for the people. And where they haven't been applied, where the remedies haven't been applied, you should find the most backward population. Because they're obviously overpopulating and starving to death. So he says, in England, when the remedies were applied, the supply of food was small. Whereas, since they have ceased to act, the remedies that is, food increases more rapidly than population. In Scotland, when subject to the remedies, the people were almost in a state of starvation. But now, they are almost as prosperous as any people whatever. In Ireland, the condition of the people is constantly improving with the withdrawal of the remedies. In France, they've been applied with great steadiness, but the supply of food has been small. In Holland, which has been comparatively little applied, the supply of food is greater than in Belgium, in which they have been more frequently called into action. So on and so forth. Right, so he's kind of tongue-in-cheek use of the remedy. He says, you know, if we were informed that the drinking of brandy was the cause of long life and health, but on a careful examination of what passes around us, were satisfied that the drinkers of brandy were neither so healthy nor so long-lived as their neighbors who did not drink it, we should be tempted to doubt the correctness of the assertion. In like manner, when we see that in those countries in which restraints upon matrimony, vice, war, pestilence, and famine exist, the people obtain food with difficulty, whereas in proportion to their absence, there is a constant improvement of conditions, we may equally doubt whether those really are the remedies provided by nature against the deficiency in the supply of the means of subsistence. And then he has a paragraph quoted from Malthus where Malthus explains his theory and everything, which I'm not going to read, but I'm just going to read the one sentence afterwards. It says, you know, that the manner in which the principles of population act is thus stated by Mr. Malthus and so on. As we've described. To all this, there is no other objection than that of being diametrically opposed to all experience, except in those countries in which the remedies are applied. So, that's how he treats Malthus and the rest of his crowd. But the key thing here is that, you know, imagine you're sitting in the United States in 1837, seeing the effects of the American system, saying, holy shit, he was living in Philadelphia. You know, at that time, Massachusetts was far and away the best place on earth to live. And you pay like 2% taxes to the support of government and everything else. 2%, I mean, imagine that. You know, you had the best education, you had the highest rates of literacy, you had the least amount of poverty, you had the highest production. This is 1837, but it was for a while, I mean. So, you know, you're in the middle of this. You're seeing the country developing and developing and developing, and you've got these guys, you know, the filling the airwaves, so to speak, with all this crap about how apparently what you're doing is bringing about famine. How does that compute, right? So the thing is, this is what he's responding to. And he's saying, look, you know, okay, you guys want to talk about this bullshit. That's fine, but I'm going to refute all of this and prove that what you have in the United States is the best system that's ever been devised by man. So that's really what he's doing. He's got no time for Malthus and these guys. But he does it with humor, and that's important.
But Rob, you said he's not promoting perception.
No.
Would you say that he considers himself a Hamiltonian, or does he?
Well, that's interesting, you know, because he has a long chapter on credit in the second volume, and he talks about the Bank of the United States, and he's comparing the credit systems of different countries, he describes how the Bank of the United States was the best bank ever, in terms of the efficiency of its the benefits that it brought to the population, how efficient it was in conducting its business. Also, the rate of bankruptcy was lower in the United States than anywhere else in the world, of default on loans and things like that. So it was a big bank. It was moving millions of dollars around. It had branches in all of the states, so you know you could transfer money really easily, you could conduct money business really easily. So he talked about it. I think he mentioned that the charter hadn't been renewed. I can't remember what year that happened in. Yeah, it's a couple years earlier, I think, maybe 34, 35. He describes it. He's definitely in favor of this, of that type of banking.
It's just before, because in 1837, you have a big crash of the, you have a big recession.
Mm.
It's just before that, in 34, I think.
Mm. Yeah. Big question you're asking there.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff talked about that a little bit last night, and we can take that up more later, for sure. But that has to do with the British Empire, especially after Lincoln's victory in the Civil War. The British adopted a policy to subvert the United States and to draw it over time into their imperial agenda, but at the same time to try to destroy from the inside this industrial nation. Right, but that's where it's coming from. Because you'd wonder, well, how the hell could you ever, if you have are in the middle of seeing this system working, how could you ever abandon it? Okay, so this is the conclusion of volume 3. So he's going to recap a few things, but there's going to be other parts from his other works that he incorporates into this also, these propositions. But we should be able to move through this fairly quickly. So somebody want to begin?
Okay.
Were there any other questions on any of the stuff that we've covered so far? Yeah. Okay, well, Malthus was saying that population inevitably increases faster than the food supply. So therefore, you never escape the problems of starvation and famine and poverty for the majority of humankind. That's essentially what Malthus was saying. But there was never, ever any proof that that was the case. And Carey proved it irrefutably. The whole book is really a refutation of that, and showing that, in fact, the reverse is true. As he says in that summary, that it's not the case that when only the best lands are cultivated and when population is scarce, is wealth abundant. He's saying far from it, that total opposite. When there's hardly any people, there's hardly any production, so how could there be more wealth? Right, but that really is the application of labor and capital to the land, which improves it, improves its quality. So that's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, but this idea that there is none is the opposite. It's just that my activity is possible.
Yeah.
So, in other words, we are in effect.
He mentioned too how, you know, you could have land in Pennsylvania that could be, that could have thousands of tons of coal upon them, and yet if there's no way to access those resources, does that land have any value? Right, the value is solely a function of human labor and the application of capital. Right, building a railway to access the coal on that land will give the land value, but there's no intrinsic value in the land itself. Right, there's no intrinsic value in resources unless we develop ways to utilize them. It's like beach sand. You know, we were when Jonathan Tenenbaum wrote this article on the isotope economy a couple of years ago. Actually, that was the, Greg, you remember that was the first time you came in, huh?
Yeah.
We read through that paper. He described how, you know, if you with various plasma technologies, you could take beach sand and transform that into resources. You could separate out the various elements and isotopes and components in it to, in an efficient enough way to make it possible, right? So then what are you talking about? Limited resources. So it, yeah. Okay, so let's,
okay.
One more point.
Sure.
The environmentalist in general would say that we have to create resistance or affect the environment itself. It's contradictory. You say human action is endangering the environment.
Uh-huh.
Yes, human action can improve its life. So
yeah.
Cutting wood as an energy supply is bad anyway. Yes.
But if Mother Nature burns down the forest, it's okay.
It's okay.
Because it's Mother Nature.
And the fact that wood lumber companies plant more
Yeah. It's a bit of a contradiction.
Okay, volume 3 summary. The following proposition embraces the several points which we have endeavored to establish. 1. That mankind tend to increase in numbers, and that under favorable circumstances they may double in from 25 to 30 years. 2. That there is a tendency to the accumulation by each generation of capital in the form of houses, farms, canals, railroads, and other machinery for the benefit of that which is to succeed it, and that, when not prevented by human interference, there must be a steady increase in the ratio of capital to population, as we know to have been the case, although in different degrees in England, Scotland, France, the United States, and other countries for centuries past. 3. That each successive generation should therefore be enabled to apply its labor more advantageously than that which preceded it, gradually substituting coal drawn from the bowels of the earth for the wood which before had been taken from the surface, iron and steel for flint, railroads and canals for horse and mule paths, ships and steamboats for canoes, the cotton of India and America and the silk of China for the skin of the ox and the sheep, the spinning jenny and the power loom for the distaff and hand loom, and the power of the steam engine for that of man, bringing into action those soils which, from difference of situation or of quality, had been deemed inferior, and with each successive substitution diminishing the severity of labor while increasing its reward. before, that the power of cultivating the soil, that from quality were deemed inferior, and obtaining therefrom a constantly increasing supply of the necessaries and conveniences of life from any given surface, tends to enable men to associate themselves together, and to combine their exertions for the increase of production and for mutual protection, thus rendering their labor more productive and promoting the further increase of capital. 5. That the increased facility of communication enables them to extend themselves over land, that by distance were rendered inferior, thus increasing the surface occupied, at the same time that population becomes more dense near the center of capital, and that every such extension tends to increase the productiveness of labor and the facility of accumulating further capital. 6. That every increase in the ratio of capital to population is attended with an increase in the ratio which the value of labor bears to that of capital, and the laborer is consequently enabled to retain a constantly increasing proportion of the product of his labor, leaving to the owner of landed or other capital a constantly diminishing proportion. 7.
What does he mean by less part of the sentence where he's saying that the profit of the labor increases? But at the end he says the owner of landed or other capital diminishes.
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing, yeah. It's an apparent form of paradox, right? Because on the one hand, maybe the landowner or the capitalist will say, I don't like this situation because I'm getting less now of like 100% of the product of my workforce. Think about an auto factory, for example. Why is it that an auto worker can command $50 or $60 an hour for his labor? Because he just has a good union? It really has nothing to do with his union. Well, he's got, the car's getting good, but more than that, how much can he produce? Right? Why can the Chinese worker or the Bangladeshi working in the sweatshop not command $50 or $60 an hour? You know, when she's working at her little, sewing machine. And yet over here, you know, if you're going to have textiles, what are you going to have? You're not going to have people sitting there with a single sewing machine. You know, maybe making a dozen shirts a day. Are you going to have some massive machine which is producing like 100,000 t-shirts a week, right? Worked by a dozen people. That's really what it, you know, why are our farmers here in Canada? We can have 4% of our population producing like 24 million tons of wheat, just wheat alone. You know, and then forget about, you know, that's not counting cattle, barley, oats, other corn. I mean, it's maybe, you know, double for our grains and things like that. I mean, obviously it's not just because they're working harder.
They're actually working
putting in more hours.
Less.
Yeah, they are working less. Right. So that's the thing that they're talking about here. And that's why this globalization thing, when I was reading this, I realized, like, when we're talking to people on the street, if we're saying that we can't compete against the cheap Chinese labor, actually that's not true at all. They can't compete with us. That's why they're cheap labor. The thing is, everybody thinks about it wrongly. Think in terms of money. But the money system's all fucked up. So what do you want to judge things in terms of money for?
If you take it to its natural conclusion,
the Nazi concentration camp. But even that is not free, right? You still got to at least have some minimum sustenance for the... but it's not even... Yeah, you'll actually have diminished production and everything. And that's what he's pointing out. And again, like when Lin says, look, the oligarchy are idiots, they don't understand anything about economics, you know, they're stupid, he'll say, yeah, but I mean, look at how powerful they are, look at all this money. Well, their system is bankrupt. And do they really think that they're going to enjoy the same quality of life in a dark age? You know, Carey quotes these examples, like these medieval kings or princes and stuff, you know. And he has this one story about such and such a duke, when he used to move from castle to castle, he took all his furniture with him and it fit on two wagons. His entire fortune fit on two wagons.
But he used to bathe in dirty clothes.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they did a lot of weird things. But you know, that's the interesting thing, is that the feudal system was not very good for the... Despite what Giulio Amato believes, you know, thinking that feudalism was a better system than the nation-state system, these guys are just idiots. They really don't... They don't get it. You know, they have no concept of that. They think that they're going to have, like Bruce once said, they think now that they've got wireless internet, you know, they're all set in cellular phones. They don't... in satellite TV. They don't need a physical economy.
I think the next paragraph.
Okay.
Seven. That notwithstanding the diminution of proportion, the capitalist obtains for the use of any given capital a constantly increasing quantity of the commodities necessary for his subsistence and enjoyment, and for the further increase of his capital.
Yeah, because things are cheaper. Yeah.
Eight, that both laborer and capitalist are consequently enabled to improve their physical condition, thereby producing a tendency to a more rapid increase of population and a more intimate association for the purpose of increasing production or of maintaining security. Nine, that with the increase of population and capital, there is a constant diminishing of the proportion of the labor of a community, or the proceeds thereof, required for the maintenance of security, which becomes daily more perfect. Labor becomes more productive, while there is a constant increase in the proportion of the product that is left for division between the laborer and the capitalist. 10. That with every increase of security, man is enabled more distinctly to perceive the advantage and propriety of respecting the rights and feelings of others, if he desired them to respect his own, and that the increased habit of association for mutual protection tends to increase the necessity for so doing, while the increased productiveness of labor offers a constantly increasing inducement to apply themselves to obtain, by honest industry, the commodities necessary for his subsistence and for the accumulation of capital, and that thus is produced a constant improvement in moral condition, tending to diminish still further the cost of maintaining security. Eleven, that the increase in the laborer's proportion tends to produce more rapid improvement in his condition than in that of the owner of capital, to diminish the distance between them, and to enable him to become himself a capitalist. 12. That consequently, with every increase of wealth, we find a change in the relative position of the laborer or the mechanic, the lawyer or the artist, and the mere capitalist. the former occupying a more, and the latter a less, prominent position in society. The former taking a larger, and the latter a smaller, proportion of the proceeds of their combined exertions. The former experiencing a constantly increasing facility for passing from the ranks of laborers or mechanics to that of capitalists, and for applying his talent and capital to promote his further advancement. Every increase of the productive power tends, therefore, to increase the proportion which the architect of their own fortunes bears to those who have inherited fortune. And with every such increase, there is a tendency to the improvement and equality of the moral condition of all classes of society.
Good so far?
Can you go back to the
point?
Sure.
He describing it as the dynamic of the opposite.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And I think there was one thing he said earlier.
That the diminished proportion which the value of capital bears to that of labor and the constant approach to equality of conditions tend to render it necessary for the capitalist to apply his time and talents to production, while it is attended with a constant increase in the value of such talent, offering a constantly increasing inducement to its exertion, and producing a constantly increasing facility for the further accumulation of capital and further improvement of physical, moral, and intellectual conditions. The more rapid the increase of the productive power, the smaller, therefore, is the proportion which the unproductive bear to the productive classes. So you're diminishing the amount of people that work.
Yeah. Because you're also, you have a further, a greater division of labor also.
Yeah.
In the productive process.
Mm-hmm. You're saying division and combination. In the other one, you think? Combination.
Combination of labor seems to be more communities coming together. But the division of labor referring to the specialization of tasks. But combination being,
yeah,
it's hard to combine your labor with somebody who's living, you know,
yes,
way far away on some other island, you know, 10 miles away, and you can't, you know, it takes you a day to walk there. So you might get eaten by a wolf or a bear. On
it's also the overhead.
Yeah, I think it's both. I think it's both. But now, you know, how much as you increase the amount overall that you're producing as a society, you know, those who are not producing anything are diminishing in proportion to the whole. Potentially in numbers. He doesn't really specify.
In terms of the capacity of society to support those who work in other
Oh, wait. Yeah, so you know what he's talking about. Yeah, this is the... He's saying that as in production, or as labor improves in its quality, it becomes more competitive with the capitalists. Therefore, the capitalists have to work harder. actually have to do something. So they have to get involved also in working.
Right.
Because otherwise they're going to lose their position in society because they're not... If capital is becoming cheaper all the time and labor is becoming more expensive.
And extended to work.
Yeah. The oligarchs don't want to hear that.
That the laborer and mechanic are, by the hope of rising, stimulated to the improvement of their intellectual condition, increase in their proportion of the constantly increasing product of labor, enables each generation to devote the constantly increasing amount of time and of capital to the improvement of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
That consequently, there is, with the increase of population, a constant increase in the proportion who read, and a rapid increase in the reward of authors, in the lovers of the arts, and in the reward of artists. The prospect of wealth and distinction thus tends to give additional stimulus to exertion on the part of the laborer, while the necessity, therefore, on the part of the capitalist, if he would maintain his position in society, is daily increasing. The increase of the productive power is therefore necessarily accompanied by a tendency to improvement and equalization in the intellectual condition of all classes of society.
Well, if you want to maintain your relative position. Like, I'm sure, you know, if you want to be the fattest, you could do that, and you could probably, you know, if you've got your family fortune, whatever, you might be able to keep doing that, but the thing is, over time, that fortune is actually diminishing in value. You know, you're not going to be able to lord it over the people who are living around you, like you might have been able to do a century in the past.
That every diminution in the proportion retained by the owner of landed and other capital tends to diminish his power to command the services of laborers, whether to be employed in the business of production or in the maintenance of power over the actions of his fellow men, while the attendant improvement of moral condition tends to diminish their disposition to exercise that power. That every increase of the laborer's proportion being attended with improved intellectual condition, he is enabled more fully to understand and to appreciate his right to equal security of person and property, to the control of his own actions and the disposition of his own property, while his improved physical and moral condition enables him more advantageously to assert it, and that there is, therefore, with the increase of wealth, a constant tendency to equality of political conditions and to the establishment of the right of self-government. 17. That every increase of population being, when not prevented by human interference, accompanied by an increase in the ratio of capital to population, there is a constant tendency to the improvement in equality of physical, moral, intellectual, and political conditions, to the further growth of population and capital, and to the further improvement of conditions. Such has been the course of events in those countries in which men have cultivated peace and goodwill among themselves and with their neighbors, and permitted population and capital to increase. But unfortunately, a large portion of the world has been employed in robbing and plundering each other, thus keeping themselves in a state of poverty by ignorance and slavery, when they should be free, virtuous, and intelligent. if you have thereby been enabled to indulge their ambition, their vanity, and their desire of distinction at the expense of the saints, well may it be said, well may it be said that, quote, God made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions. The whole science of political economy may be reduced to a single line. Do unto others as ye would that others should do unto you.
Wow. Pretty cool, huh? Hey, you guys should move up if you're able to. It'd be a lot easier. I just can't hear you, that's all. But also, we're recording, so if we have discussion, then it's good to be recorded. Come on up.
When he talks about capitalism, does he mean that the people who are the borrowers of money?
He means, yeah, the people that are lending, yeah, the bankers, but also, you know, the individuals who own factories. You know, anybody who owns a certain amount of wealth that's able to invest it in different things.
It could be money, but it could be also through machinery.
Yeah, right. The owner, the people who own the means of production. Can we increase the
labor?
The labor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really what he's talking about.
About quality of labor or amount? What he's dealing with here, I think, is the quality of labor. How much can you produce in a day?
Because I'm actually because after theory, the economy by growth, the learning by doing, mm-hmm. you increase the amount of capital.
Mm-hmm.
People who are working can learn and grow, they are intelligent, mm-hmm. so able to produce more and more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's the thing, is there is a relationship between capital and the labor force, that they're reinforcing each other. When the economy is functioning properly, under a good government, the you've got a policy here as a nation to develop. If you have that policy, I mean, that's the thing that, you know, I think the average person out there, when they think about economics or political economy, you know, policy of government regarding the economy, get really freaked out by it as if it's some huge, complicated thing. When, I mean, there are elements that are complicated, and we'll get into some more complicated stuff. This is a theory of what LaRouche is, the way he's looking at it, but it's only complicated because we don't have a scientific culture anymore, and we've got to rebuild that. But like Carrie's saying, the essential rules are, I mean, the United States launched the American system without knowing all of Lynn's economics. What LaRouche brings now is a much more scientific and thoroughgoing understanding and the ability to forecast much more accurately. Like, he takes what Carey is doing and takes it to a much higher level. But the thing is, even so, like, what they were doing in the United States, it comes down to what Carey said at the end. That basic rule, that fundamental rule that Jesus talks about. It's not really complicated. You just do good. The universe will reward you for doing good and for thinking about the future. Because, and actually, you know, this leads into an important thing. Just before we move on to the next part, so this is another graph of European population. Now, you'll notice that there's four letters here, right? Mm-hmm. Well, these Carey would refer to as the effects of disturbing causes. That is, the inventions of man which affect the progress of nations, right? Being like war. Inventions. At first, I thought, what is he talking about? Technological inventions or what? But he's referring to something from a line from the Bible, And what he means is, you know, like these kind of little games. They invent little games and tricks to play on each other. Now, you've got these 4 points here. Okay. Now, this is World War II. Okay. This year, although the dates are small down here, but this plunge is happening during the 30 Years' War. Right, that ends around 1650, when the 30 Years' War ends, and the population starts to take off. This is the collapse that occurs during the Dark Age that Val described. And the one down here happens during the Roman period. Now, interesting, the one D seems to be the least steep of all. But let's put it in a different time frame. Or this one, this is another one which has slightly different estimates on the collapse of the population. So if we, you know, give the Romans the benefit of the doubt. But that's what happened under Rome. So now that's an example of a system where the opposite of which, you know, is happening, from what Carrie's saying. This
population
is, that's 36. Population 400 BC to 1000 AD.
So in
8 millions, yeah.
Years.
So in about 200, at the, and this is roughly the time that Edward Gibbon sets the beginning of his decline and fall of the Roman Empire. You've got about 36 million people in Europe. And by the time of, well, the collapse in the West happens around 500. So by 600, that the population's fallen to maybe 26 million, approximately. So that's a pretty major collapse. At its height, it's about 35 or 36 million. So that's massive at the time.
We know,
think about that.
What's the changes? You had the Roman Republic, and then you had the Roman Empire kind of stuff, like when the emperor just took over.
Yeah. Well, the
I just remember from
Well, this period from around 180. See, you had a couple of emperors which were thought of as a little bit better. They were called the Antonines. And they were ruling in the, from say 96, the Antonines were a couple of them, but there was a string of emperors who were a bit more, well, they weren't great guys, but they weren't like Caligula or Nero who were, you know, Caligula who would build a bridge and then let the people go on the bridge and check it out and then have his guards push them over into the river, right? I mean, that's the kind of guy that Caligula was. But yeah, you got some real lunatics, but these guys were, you know, the Romans, after a century of this, of Caesar's line of these total lunatics, they got a few emperors who were a little bit better. They built some walls and some fortifications. Better than nothing, I guess. But anyway, I think that just the result, you know, of Europe as a whole was able to progress a little bit, but, you know, I think when you reach this point, the cause of this decline is really, the roots of it are much earlier. You know, I mean, I would say. So. But something interesting here, just before we go on, you see with Greece, this is really extraordinary. Now, you want to get a sense of the effect of these kinds of collapses on civilization. You take Greece, okay? 1000 BC. You know, this was, Greece was, well, they were in a dark age at this point, so there's a million people. They've got 7.7 people per kilometer. Okay? 400 BC, at the end of the Peloponnesian War, you've got 3 million, there's 23 people per square kilometer. Probably, before the Peloponnesian War, that number was higher. Okay, so that's a, I mean, they tripled the population density And at that time, I mean, that's pretty good. 200 BC, it's fallen to 2.5 million, 19 per square kilometer. Now, 200 BC, well, like 150 BC, roughly the Romans have conquered, 149 BC, they've conquered Greece. So from this point onwards, Greece is effectively under the rule of the Roman Empire. 81 down to 2 million, 15.3 per square kilometer. Then 2 million people, 15.3. Then it's down to 1.5 million people, 11.5 per square kilometer. Then 800,000 people in AD 600, and it's 6.15 per square kilometer. So they went from 23 per square kilometer, they collapsed by 75%, essentially. And probably from before the Peloponnesian War, at the height of the classical period, it would have been even higher. Because, I mean, a lot of people died in the Peloponnesian War. There's famine, plague, all kinds of stuff. So now, you know, I looked up, because I was curious about this, well, what's the population of Greece today? And when did they recover back to, say, you know, what they were at the height? And they didn't recover from that collapse, the collapse of through the Peloponnesian War, like what LaRouche will talk about, until the 19th century.
They were all dead and
all. The population went up and down. We don't have statistics really before 1800, but it's in the early 1800s, they're reaching back up towards a million people.
But it's not just the Peloponnesian War, though.
No, but you see, that brings about, that's their civilization collapsing. The Peloponnesian War doesn't end Greek civilization. It's Greek civilization coming, you know, collapsing, which causes the Peloponnesian War, really. You know, because it's the ideas and the culture which are driving them, which drive them into the war.
What I'm saying is, it seems as though the population collapsed
in
the first early centuries AD.
Yeah, right, under the rule of Rome and the collapse of the civilization in the Mediterranean in general. What you want to think about is you had this advanced Greek civilization which self-destructs, but it never recovers because first it's under Rome, then it's under the Byzantine Empire, then it's under the Ottoman Empire, and it's a war zone for a thousand years or more, you know. So you just want to think about the implications of that. For Greek civilization, well, really, they've never recovered. Yeah, they never recovered. So that's an example of the opposite of what Carey is discussing, or if you don't apply what Carey is discussing. So. Okay, so the physical economy of Lyndon H. LaRouche. Now, of course, I wanted to start with a, you know, this is something from this book here, which, you know, we have copies of, but so you wish to learn all about economics, you can download it off of WLYM.com, get your own copy. And I took this from that book. He says, the science of physical economy is the study of the means by which we increase our creative and productive powers. This is the primary matter of economic science. Mm-hmm. But I'd say a more advanced conception. Now, Lynn often references, he's referred to, for those of you who know, don't answer this, but for those who are new to this, what do you think the first statement of economic policy in history, when do you think it would have occurred? The first statement of economic policy or economic science in history, in general. When was the first statement? When does that occur? Any idea? Anybody want to take a guess?
No, what is the cat supposed to do?
Hmm?
Does anyone know? Can I ask that?
Yeah, yeah. Take a guess, sure.
The Book of Genesis.
Yeah. You win the prize. The fabled verses 26, 27, and 28. Now, it's, my sister was supposed to come tonight, and it's unfortunate because she would have got all freaked out at this part. So I was a bit disappointed, but... So does somebody want to read these three verses?
The first economic statement in history. Then God said, quote, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." For God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, quote, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth."
So, Rush put out a 2-hour video back in 88, I think, called The Power of Labor. And he started, and it's funny, you can check it out, it's on our website also. It's got these this really corny introduction where you're kind of zooming in on a galaxy, and then all of a sudden you hear this, like this thunder, you know, the screen flashing and everything, and it's like, "And God said," "And God blessed them," and God said, anyway, it's really, it's funny, but it's so he starts off, and this is, so I'm going to follow a little bit the thread of the argument that he makes in this, but the question is, what is meant by to be fruitful? How do we measure? And I think Carey is addressing that, like that concept. So, you know, just to return to this again, to keep this in mind. And I think it's of note that with the Renaissance, because, you know, we'll say, well, this is a revolution in civilization. And yet, if you look at the... if you look at afterwards, well... I mean, that line seems pretty flat, and we know that there's actually a dip that happens afterwards, right, with the 30 Years War. Mm-hmm. But, or if you go back, there's the other one's a little bit better. This one, see, there's an upward trend, right, but when it really takes off is, again, after the Treaty of Westphalia. So although you get the breakthrough with the Golden Renaissance, the political conditions in Europe are still not sufficient to have the full flourishing of what the Renaissance meant, the potential of the Renaissance. But when you have the, finally with the Treaty of Westphalia, the establishment of the nation-state system as the standard of practice amongst nations, now you have the conditions in Europe, even though, I mean, there's still wars and other things going on, but you have the general conditions to allow the kind of technological and cultural progress to occur, which the Renaissance represented, at least in potential. Okay, so that's... So, and, you know, it's also, I think, relevant to note that political economy as an area of study doesn't really... It doesn't exist before the nation state. Right, it's not an accident that you talk about national economies, the development of economies. You know, and when you first get nation states, now you have the challenge, well, how do you develop these things? These big unwieldy things, and all these people with their varying interests. Well, how do you make this work? You know, and that's really when people start to think about these questions. So, So this is what we're looking at. Now, right. So obviously here, you know, you're talking about population density, right, and the increase of this over time, and Carey alludes to this, right, that as capital increases, as the productivity of the population increases, you can fit more people per square kilometer. Right? And this is a sign of the progress of civilization. Also, you think about it in terms of Canada. We have a map here. Now, you got this massive nation. It's 9 million square kilometers. Well, a bit more than that. Now, you got 32 million people. How the hell are we going to make this nation productive with 32 million people? Like, for example, how do you maintain an infrastructure system like that? Like a high-speed rail system. Like, why, for example, would it not be a bad idea to build a high-speed rail between Kapuskasing and Hearst? Why would you not build a high-speed rail system there? But why would you build one between, say, Quebec, well, to start Montreal, and Windsor, and then connecting to Detroit? Why would that be an efficient place to build a system initially? Hopefully, eventually, Hearst and Kapuskasing will have a high-speed rail system. Maybe not yet. But this has to do with population density. Like, if you think about that rail line, you're going to build that. Well, how many people live in that area whose activities will support the maintenance of that system? Right? So this is one of the key considerations for the development of the nation. And this is why Canada also needs, you know, 300-400 million people. Because most of the country's empty. Maybe even a billion. Maybe, why not? Got a lot of space. You know, for example, I was thinking that this area here is a real problem. I mean, that really has to be developed. Because what you'll have huge amounts of population here, and then you'll get the prairies, which are reasonably developed. I mean, you're not going to want to fill that place with cities necessarily, because that's where you're growing all your food. You could have much more developed small cities and towns, but this area here is virtually empty. So there's really nothing going on. You know, but if you want to start building real transcontinental systems, you want to have a policy to develop these areas. There's lots of mineral resources there. Why couldn't we build up manufacturing there also? You got the Great Lakes. If you have a high-speed rail system, you can actually make it efficient to move products back and forth across the country. So you could actually have a national economy instead of being, you know, having all of your population living along the American border and depending upon exports to sustain your population, and then seeing the U.S. economy tanking and saying, holy fuck, you know, 50% of our economy is directly tied to you guys, and you're going down. You know, we got people out on the street saying, but it's okay, man, we've got water. Well, okay.
You should drown yourself.
Sure. So, you know, that's one of Canada's biggest problems. Instead of, you know, bitching about the United States taking us over, let's build our nation, right? And start making more babies. That's a good thing. Right now, we wouldn't be able to sustain our population if we didn't have huge numbers of immigrants, which are fine. That's not a problem. But, you know, you want to have a population that's actually reproducing, you know, at a rate to sustain itself. But, of course, that's also a function of the collapse. You know, if you could make enough income to support 5 kids, and you're not a baby boomer, you'd probably have 5 kids. Because kids are fun. Yeah. Unless they stop being poop factories. But but anyway, that's another story. Okay, so this question of population density. But, you know, LaRouche says, look, it's not just enough to measure the population density because...
Mm-hmm. Like, sure. Also point out, though, in the past that, you know, you need generally more kids if you're labor-intensive. You have, like, a lot of farming stuff, you employ a lot of farms. But then, as your technology increases, you require less.
Yeah.
you know, kids for farms or whatever,
mm-hmm.
then as labor intensity goes down, and really, I mean, society doesn't necessarily need 5 kids per household. Like, you know,
why not? Well, the thing is now, instead of having the 5 kids working on the farm from the time that they're 8 or 10 years old, they can be in school until they're 24 or 25 and come out much more productive and able to do something a lot more useful. Because think about it, I mean, if you always have more young people than you have old people, then it's less costly per capita to support the older people. And you can support them at a higher quality of, higher standard of living. Because you also want to have a lot of old people. You don't want them to die off, really. Because they can still be useful and decide, you know, I mean, you want old people to be able to pass on the wisdom and the traditions of the culture to the young. You know, that's one of, historically, I think in most societies, that was a role of the, you know, the grandparents were not seen as a cost to the family, but they were there to actually help train the children and pass on the stories, you know, going back to, like Lynn will often talk about sitting around these dinners, family dinners, and listening to his, you know, his grandfather tell these stories. So he would have a sense of history going back over 100 years. You know, under the Civil War period and things like that. So that's important. But also it means that the longer people are able to live, the longer they're able to be productive. Baby boomers think they turn 55, freedom 55, right? That's their thing. They're trying to get out of being productive as fast as possible. But most of them were never productive in the first place. So. I mean, they're a net loss. Maybe it's better. They've been practicing for retirement for 35 years. So the thing with population density then also you have to consider is the land, for example, right? I mean, a mountain compared to a plain, some places near a river. I mean, depending on your infrastructure development and so forth, you also have you have to account for that when you're measuring different countries, because you want to be fair, right, in judging these kinds of questions, right? So you want to have a sense of the difference, even though you can improve land or ruin it, you have to account for that when you're measuring changes. And then, of course, he talks about potential. I can write this down. It's the term to... Now, what do we mean by potential? Like here's a good example, right? I mean, because you want to measure how many people you actually have at any given time, but that's not really sufficient either, because usually in a successful economy, you can support a lot more people than you currently have. That's why you're able to expand your population and not have the result that Malthus talks about. So, what is that potential? And today, for example, you know, this is another reason why we say the crisis started in the early 1970s. This is when the world economy started collapsing in physical terms. And yet, it's taken 38 years 37 since the bubble blew out last year, but if we're still in the process, you know, people say, well, are you sure the collapse is here? Things look pretty nice out, it's a sunny day. But it's taken over 35 years for that potential population density to collapse below the level of the actual population. That's what we're seeing. That's whenever you know, we've had these collapses in the past, like during the 14th century during the Roman period. That's what you're seeing. Like, remember that graph from Rome. The potential population density of the Roman Empire was collapsing before the population collapsed. Okay. So you want to be able to measure that. And the best, optimally, that potential to support people should be increasing even faster than your population. Right? And that's... But you know, how does this, so, you know, LaRue says, well, this is your measure, the measure of your fruitfulness. You know, how is that increasing? And how is the rate of increase increasing? Okay, because that's important also. That's where you get, why you get the, it's not simply a geometric curve, but it is exponential. Really.
So potential relative.
Well, that's the measure of your fruitfulness, as Lynn says. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because that's telling you how many people could you support. What's the maximum number of people you could support?
Yes, if you say that it was approximately around the time of John Smith's space program,
mm-hmm.
we approximately had somewhere in the ballpark of relative population density of 25 billion at that point, in terms of with that point in our economy, investment in technology,
mm-hmm.
we could have had an upper limit of approximately 25 billion people that could have been sustained at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Now today, it's much less than that.
Mm-hmm.
Like 500 years ago.
Yeah.
So this is something you have to think about. Yeah. It is very, very common. For right now, we can't even produce the food to sustain 6.5 billion people in Paris.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you notice in those, the numbers that we were looking at that little chart last night, how I think in 1990, then 2000, right, the per capita production, it had been stagnant. So you can imagine if this policy kept going, then you start to see the actual collapse, you know, even lower per capita. So, okay, the thing is, how do we produce these increases? That's the next question. We have a measure. We know now what we want to measure. We should be asking ourselves, how do we produce these increases or decreases? Hopefully increases. And for that, you got to go back again to the Renaissance. So I got a couple pictures here. Now, you know Cuza? The chap here, the pious fellow? But there's two other fellows here also, Leonardo da Vinci and this is Luca Pacioli. And they were working, Da Vinci in particular, on machinery, I guess he was producing all kinds of different weapons and things like that, taking the motions of the human body and finding the optimal forms of weapons to maximize the effect of the arm coming down and things like that, finding he was developing helicopters and all kinds of stuff. There's all kinds of stuff he was doing. Da Vinci, yeah, he's also the painter. You know, one of these universal geniuses, and people don't say, I don't think many people understand how he could be a universal genius, but Lynn's an example of that also.
Well, did you see, like, that Franklin, he was a super or something?
Yeah.
Anything.
Yeah, right. But Cuza, you know, being the father of the modern nation state, and also the founder of modern science, and LaRouche has referenced this point of the squaring of the circle. And this is something maybe we can pick up later as a pedagogical proof that the circle is transcendent relative to the square. James' eyes are crossing right now. But we'll uncross them later. But what Cuza elaborates is a method of discovery. Okay, and this method and also of course what he was doing around the Council of Florence are really sparked this huge upsurge in technological progress, in cultural progress and breakthroughs in classical art, which Pacioli and Da Vinci are engaged in. Pacioli is important also because of, Val and I are actually working through a book of his called The Divine Proportion, where they're looking at you've got the Platonic solids up here in the corner, and the great question is, why are there only five Platonic solids, that is, five ways of equally dividing the surface of a sphere? Okay. Well, the work that Pacioli, and we'll come back to that later, but Pacioli and Da Vinci and these guys and Cuza and the work of people collaborating with them form the basis for modern science, which is known in the form of Johannes Kepler. And LaRouche's line is outlined for our youth movement, the task of mastering the ideas of these four men in particular. This is Kepler, Gottfried Leibniz, Carl Gauss, and Bernard Riemann. And Leibniz is the guy who really found the science of physical economy. And Birgit was telling us that when she was going to school, when was that? Okay. She was still learning then, the students were still learning about Leibniz and how, and the development of steam technologies and the industrial era in Germany and so forth. So there's even at that point, you know, in Germany, there's a recognition of the role of Leibniz in development of physical economy. And Leibniz picks up off of the work of Kuza, but what he really develops is a concept of the principle of least action.
Checking right up for people. This one is very important.
Now, least action. Does anybody want to try to describe what the principle of least action is? For those who don't know?
That would be the least action.
Perhaps not.
I never got the idea, so let me see if I can try.
Okay, maybe. Sure. Okay. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Least action, I would assume that the maximum
Do you have an example?
Not really.
is it maximum efficiency?
Well, but what determines something to be maximally efficient?
The energy required for the action.
Okay, yeah. Maximum output for minimum effort. Well, you could geometrically, does anybody know how you describe that geometrically? What the geometrical figure would be for that relationship? Now, this is something we can test out later also if you want, because it's interesting to do it. But for now, I'll just say that the circle is the area which has the least circumference has the largest area, right, for any given circumference. And one way to do it is if you took a piece of string, and you looped it, right, so you had a given length, you could make a circle, or, roughly enough for experimental purposes. You could also make a rectangle, square, triangle, different shapes. And you could try to measure what the area is of each of those figures. And what you'll find is that the circle gives you the maximum area. Okay? But this is also the central principle of technology, because what determines whether or not a new technology is worthy of being introduced into an economy?
Production for the same amount of effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, otherwise, why would you spend money on it? Like biofuels are a good example of a bad form of technology. If you're using more energy to produce it than you're ever going to get back, mm-hmm. or like solar panels are similar, wind power and things like that. Right. So, an another example of this, right? Like, well, Lin uses this in his book of knives. I mean, why, when you take a knife, why do you not use the flat side of the blade to cut the orange? Anybody want to take a
chance? Be a long time till breakfast.
Yeah, probably. But why will it be a long time till breakfast? Or why? Yeah, but why is it inefficient? What did? Or I mean, maybe take the example. Well, we could actually
more energy to get the a much sloppier.
There. Why do the knives in the kitchen suck? I think every day I think, God damn, these knives are such a poor energy plus density. No, not really. But they are rather dull. So why, okay, why do we say a knife that can't cut very well is dull, right? It's not, and why do we consider that to be a poor knife as compared to something that is much sharper? Why does a sharp knife
because
cut more efficiently?
It takes more of your energy and you cut less out of it.
Okay, but why does it do that? What is it about the sharper knife that has that function?
The physical geometry of the knife.
How so?
Does it condense? Yeah, the power and the energy condenses.
Onto a thinner edge.
Yeah.
So that the surface that you're the edge of the knife, that is the actual surface of the orange that is in contact with the knife, is much smaller in the sharp knife than in the dull knife.
Yeah.
So then, the power that you're, the motion of your arm, or the pressure downwards upon the orange, is much greater than, right, per area of measurement.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Is that what you call? Is that the basic idea of energy plus density?
Right.
You could also think of it the other way, like on a flatter blade, the power and energy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another example is up here on the board, which he uses in the book. So they're looking at the energy flux densities of various energy sources. Right, so, and this is the argument in favor of nuclear energy. We can get caught up in other things on the street, but when it comes down to it, this is really the argument. If you look at the difference between solar, because what's the problem with solar, right? I mean, you can't create more radiation coming from the sun than is coming from the sun. Right, so there's a certain cap on how efficient, no matter how efficient you make the thing, I mean, it can't capture more energy than there is being issued from the sun. I mean, maybe you could put the solar panel closer to the sun, but still, there's a certain limit there, right? And it's
you just start making it get pretty cold, and the difficulty growing crops too.
Yeah. Right, so, now compared to fossil fuels, right, or fission energy fusion, and fusion in the future. These are projected, obviously, at this point. There's also, I found in one of our 21st centuries, some numbers on this. And for example, if you had, for 1 kilogram of fuel, okay, how many kilowatt hours of electricity would be produced? So if you took hardwood, the burning wood, 1 kilogram of fuel would produce 1 kilowatt hour. Of energy. Coal would produce 3. Heavy oil, petroleum, 4. Natural gas, 6. Natural uranium, 50,000. Low enriched uranium, 250,000. Uranium with reprocessing, which is the stuff that we're getting into now with the latest generation reactors, 3,500,000. And plutonium with reprocessing, 5 million. And then you go into fusion, right, which is going to be even beyond that. So that, now, this is interesting, what you're seeing, because it's not, there's a difference in, also within technology, because you can take a machine and you can figure out a way, simply by maybe rearranging the parts, or it's a drill, maybe putting a better drill bit on, maybe using diamonds instead of steel or something like that to cut. And you can bring about improvements in the technology and increases in productivity. But there's a big difference between that and moving from a petroleum-based economy to nuclear in terms of the potential of that economy in physical terms. Right. How much cheaper is it to produce energy? I mean, a nuclear plant, material-wise, compared to a coal plant, it's not going to be that much different. Now when you start to mass-produce these things. So, you know, with the price of gas now, obviously, you know, natural gas is going out the window. But even so, if it was at the $40 a barrel or something, you still can't compare the energy output, right, for the input in building this stuff compared to what you get out of it. It's off the charts. Right? This is what you call a technological revolution. You know, a similar example you get with not in this one, with maglev trains. Okay, this is really interesting. We published this. We sell a few copies. You can get it online. But it's talking about maglev transport for the 21st century. He gives the author of this has been involved in maglev development for a long time, but he gives some details here, because now you'd probably think to move a train at 300 miles per hour is going to take a lot of energy, right? Probably more than to drive a car at 60 miles an hour, you'd think. But actually, at 300 miles per hour in the open atmosphere, maglev consumes only 0.4 megajoules per passenger mile, compared to 4 megajoules per passenger mile of oil fuel for a 20 miles per gallon auto that carries 1.8 people, the national average, at 60 miles per hour. So you're using a tenth of the energy to move somebody 5 times the speed. He says at 150 miles per hour, maglev consumes only 0.1 megajoules per passenger mile, which is just 2% of the energy consumption of a typical 60 mile per hour automobile. In low pressure tunnels or tubes, like those proposed for Switzerland's metro system, energy consumption per passenger mile will shrink to the equivalent of 10,000 miles per gallon. Now, I was actually listening to a class that you gave on the Anglo-Dutch system recently, and you, Jason made a point in this, that how do you measure an economy? Can you really honestly use the currency of, say, a petroleum or coal-based economy to measure a nuclear-based economy? People today try, but of course, they also think that the economy goes up if there's more money in circulation. Right? But if you think about the potential for action in your economy, potential for movement of goods, of people, for the productive powers of labor, that's when you think in those terms, which are the real world, then it's very clear that you can't simply use money to understand anything about economics. Just like Carrie is saying, what is the difference between the value of labor for somebody, we could say in this case, somebody who doesn't have access to advanced technology than somebody who does. You know. So, again, with Maglev, what you're seeing is those kinds of differences. That's a revolution. It's not simply an improvement. That's a revolution in transportation. Okay. So these are things to think about when we're thinking about economics. Right. So now, LaRouche in this book also, he put out a chart, although I'm not, I'll use this one, it's easier to see. So I tried my hand at making a table even this time, so I'm getting more fancy with my PowerPoint presentation. But this chart here is very important. Okay, we got a sense of technology, we got a sense of energy flux density, right, that this is important, because as the population density, the potential population density increases in your economy, you've also got to make things more efficient. You've got to have a higher, better quality of energy production and so forth. And as he mentions in this book, that as population increases, as your economy advances, you also have to have increases in power production, in energy production. And people have to consume more energy. Like in the future, we're going to consume vastly greater amounts of energy. When we get fusion, you start to get plasma technologies involved, things like that. Okay. Now,
you mean in by consuming, it's kind of also employed.
Yeah, that's maybe employ is a better way. We're going to employ more energy for the production of goods.
Yeah, we're going to require more energy.
It's like maglev. You consume a maglev by using it. Now. So when you're talking about economy, how are you going to measure these changes? And Lynn brings up they give a market basket. So you're going to look at all the goods that are being produced. You're going to look at a standard. What are the standard goods that people are consuming? You know, in terms of transportation, housing, food, leisure, things like that. So you have a standard of measurement. Then you want to look at how that's changing over time. But you also want to look at your population as a whole and changes that are occurring in the labor force. So you have, can everybody see this at all from the back? Okay, so what you have obviously with your workforce, you have these three sections. You have agriculture, you have industry, and then other. That's for all those people in the office building. They don't really do anything.
We're artists.
That's the thing, is it's very simple to take care of them because they don't do anything, so you don't really have to worry about, you just have to worry about how many of them there are, if there's, you know, if they're multiplying too rapidly, which is the problem today. Okay, so obviously you've got your young people who are not in the labor force, you've got your elders who are out of the labor force, and then you have, you know, the ones that are actually able to be employed. Now, same thing with agriculture. And LaRouche in his book, he says, you know, think about your economy as what he calls a consolidated agro-industrial firm. You want to think of it as one business, right, where that business has to reproduce itself constantly. So, how do you measure how well it reproduces itself? Well, you want to look at a few things. You want to look at this bar here. Okay. Now, C. What does C represent? C represents capital goods, the capital cost of maintaining your economy. Now, I'll just refer to this one, but we're including both here, really. So you've got C. Now, because this is a consideration, like anybody who owns a factory, you have expenses to maintain your machinery, maintain your facilities, maintain your infrastructure and everything else. Right? So that's something that you can't start gouging that. Otherwise, your machines are not going to work very well. But those in the other don't really understand that. anyway. Then you've got V. This represents your labor force. You know, the cost of maintaining your workers, right, at a given standard, right, of employment and so forth. Now you have D, and you see this arrow going from D to the other.
Wait, what's the other?
Well, other refers to your unproductive expense. Maybe we could say D for degenerate. I don't know.
Hey, we're in D, okay?
Well, I don't know. We might be more productive than most people out there. But no, it's true that there is stuff about D which is important. Okay? I shouldn't flag it too much.
Well,
this represents, okay, you could say this bar represents the total production of the society.
Yeah.
Okay? And that's divided into certain portions. A portion will go towards maintaining your capital stock. A portion will go to maintaining your labor force. A portion will go to V is the productive labor force. Okay? A portion D goes towards maintaining your unproductive part of your population. And then S prime, there's a little prime there. S prime is your net profit.
Did you just give it a letter?
S might also represent surplus, you could say. After you, at the end of the productive cycle, after you've deducted the cost for, well, I'm not sure why he picked that number, that letter in particular, but because you also have S here, right? And this S is your gross profit. After production, after you've accounted for the cost of production, how much do you have left?
Some of that goes to your non-productive labor force, but the other part should be, so that's your real net profit. But then, where are the overhead expenses?
Well, that's D. D is your overhead.
That's in D. Okay,
yeah.
So administrative services.
Yeah, it's administration, education, healthcare, things like this. Yeah. People that are not directly engaged in production go into your overhead. But not all of that is bad, right? I mean, you need people for administration.
Yeah.
You need political organizers.
Healthcare.
You need healthcare,
yeah,
right?
And
so,
teachers.
Yeah, exactly.
So you should also be investing in using part of your profit.
Well, that's what this indicates. Yeah, this portion of your total goods output goes towards supporting. That's why the arrow leads back here. Well, that's your other. If you look at your workforce as a population, you have young people that can't work. You have your labor force, mature. You have the old folks. And then what he wants to look at here is this is your productive workforce. So he's just distinguishing between the non-productive, and the productive. That's what he's doing. But with the productive, the workforce here, he includes the youth and the elders because, you know, families, right? The basic economic unit is a household, which incorporates young people, old people, and those who are actually able to work. So you want to keep them together, just like you keep in agriculture. Right, the young people, elders, and right, because this is taking into account the family unit. Then you keep other up here. So you have, after you subtract your capital costs and your labor costs, you have your gross profit, which is S. Or as you see over here, S is equal to T, that is the total goods output, this whole line, minus C plus V, minus this, okay? Now, once you subtract your overhead, and there's a reason that we make this distinction, you have your net profit, which is S prime. Okay? So that's, at the end of a productive cycle, that's what you have left over to reinvest into your economy.
And the reason you make this distinction is because you need to invest in the seed. You need some type of investment in the seed. So you use some of your profit to upgrade those things.
Yeah. Do we have a laser pointer at all? This would be a lot easier. Hey, Pascal, do we have a laser pointer?
Oh, yeah.
Let's use technology.
We like technology.
We like it.
We like it. Yeah, but
and one of the reasons also is you want to analyze your economy as well and analyze different ratios.
All right. Here we go. Now we're into the 21st century.
Okay.
Rulers.
Okay. So you have your gross profit, which I explained. You then have capital intensity. Right? And this is something that Terry was referring to. Right? That is how much machinery, Alexander Hamilton refers to it as artificial labor. Right? That is how much per worker can you bring to bear to aid in his production? Right? Machinery, transportation, so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's capital intensity. Then you have your productivity. And here you take what is the ratio between S, that is the gross profit, right, and the cost of maintaining your capital stock and your productive workforce. So that tells you how productive each of your workers is. You then have the rate of profit. So the only difference here is you take S prime. So after you deduct your overhead costs, what is the ratio of the surplus that you have at the end of the productive cycle relative to the cost of supporting the production? And then you have your expense ratio, that is D divided by C plus V. Okay, so the question, of course, being how much is your overhead? How much is the cost of your overhead relative to the cost of supporting your production? Now, of course, today, this is the big problem we have, is that D is expanding wildly out of control relative to the rest of the economy. Right, we've got a shrinking productive base and an increasing number of useless people who don't do anything and massive debt payments, right, that have to be made.
S prime probably doesn't even exist.
Right. And at the same time, our C is decreasing wildly.
Yeah.
Because a lot of our industries and different manufacturing, whatever, entrepreneurs and many corporations, in order to deal with the debt burden, have been cutting their capital budget, investment in their capital infrastructure and upgrading.
Yeah, right.
Or outsourcing to less capital intensive factories overseas.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay.
And D is decreasing too, because our skilled labor force is
disappearing.
Yeah.
Like, I think already this year, the U.S. has lost 200,000 manufacturing jobs. Net loss. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, think also that in the 1950s, even in the 1950s, approximately 50% of the U.S. workforce was involved in directly in production, whereas today it's probably less than 20%.
Like services.
Yeah.
Some people call that higher level employment. Services.
Yeah.
No, right. I mean, people take that seriously.
They got a room on that.
We're moving to a higher level.
We've got a room on the second floor of the whorehouse. That's what. That's about what all it means. Okay, now LaRouche also talks about that you want to analyze this also in terms of thermodynamics. What he means by this, if we think in terms of energy, the total energy required to maintain the society, he says that's equal to C plus V plus D. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that's what you need to expend in every productive cycle in order to maintain things. Without the system running down. So C plus V obviously is the energy of the system of production. that's what's required to keep things. So some of these are similar to what we had up. He's just assigning a different name to it. Okay? S prime in this case is the free energy of the economic process. Now what you want to look at also, like before, what is the ratio of free energy to energy of the system of production? Okay? And what is the ratio of free energy to energy of the system as a whole?
Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. Why would you... So Yeah.
Why would you want to do that?
Well, I kind of figured out. I'm not really clear on why the difference...
Why the difference is important?
Yeah, no, because I guess the first one, you want to know how much your profit is compared to the energy required to run your entire system.
Mm-hmm.
But then you want to set the, that's the last one at the bottom. Mm-hmm. But then the one before that, you want to know what's your profit relative to your productive work.
Mm-hmm. Well, one reason for that, because you have, there are lots of examples of overhead expenses, like speculation, gambling, and so forth, that have nothing to do with production. So you have other things which are related to production, like education, healthcare, and so forth.
Right.
So you want to look both at how much surplus your economy is producing, how productive the workforce is and your capital base, how much free energy they're producing. But you also want to be able to compare that to, well, what happens if you include all the overhead in? How does that change the ratio? Because, today, if we were to calculate S prime divided by C plus V, we might get a positive number. But if we were to then incorporate the overhead in, there's no way that we're going to get a ratio that indicates that the economy is producing a surplus.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
So basically, everything there has to be the price.
Yeah. Well,
I think it's more an exploration of different parts of the economy. It's an exploration of
this is going to explain things a little bit.
I think it's important though to clarify that.
Yeah, okay, so basically, this whole thing.
Uh-huh.
And if you use the tools, okay, then there should be capital, but at the same time, the capital.
Right. Well, think about it. I mean, is your economy doing well if you produce less than is required to maintain your system? That's probably a bad situation. I mean, that's when you start deciding you'll get eaten, right? First the dog, then it's... Well, Janie, I'm sorry to... Daddy's got to keep working with the other kids.
It's medical experiments for the lot of you.
So, Bob, basically, I would say that based on the system itself, right?